You're listening to CJLO 1690 AM.
For CJLO News, I'm Cédric Gallin. Concordia is proposing new measures to ease exam pressure due to pandemic-related stress. These new options include a pass notation for one course per term, meaning a student could choose a pass grade instead of their actual grade. Another change is that F grades are now automatically changed to a discontinued class. This system will be in place for fall 2020, but also for winter 2021. For more information, please consult concordia.ca. Also, Canadians are struggling with their mental health. That's according to a study from the Canadian Mental Health Association. Partnered with the University of British Columbia, the study found that the majority of Canadians are preoccupied by this pandemic, with over half fearing the death of a loved one. 10% of Canadians have had suicidal thoughts, compared to the 2.5% in 2016. Nursing science professor at UBC, Emily Jenkins, says they, quote, found a direct relationship between social stress factors and the decline of mental health. In other news, the United Kingdom is the first country to authorize the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. As early as next week, doses will be administered according to the UK's priority patient list, with a first batch of 800,000 doses from the 40 million ordered by the UK. For more stories, visit cjlo.com/news.
Hello, my name is Evie. You are listening to a new segment of the Resonance podcast series called Virtual Agents of Care. I'm here today with fellow humans called Mark, Donna, Valerie and Elise to talk about artificial intelligence in healthcare. Now, have you ever heard of Watson? Watson is a computer system developed by IBM, named after the company's founder, Thomas Watson. The software was first designed as a diagnostic aid that helped health professionals, and is probably best known for its participation on the game show Jeopardy in 2011. Now, Watson, or adaptations of it, is a research assistant and librarian committed to a broad assortment of challenges.
So AI tools offer considerable possibilities that wouldn't exist without them. This is not just because computers are excellent calculators and data storage centers, but because they're really good at learning. However, when I say learning, I'm talking about a very particular kind of learning, because there's a strong tendency to treat machine cognition as though it were human cognition. And that leads to a logical conclusion that computers are a version of people. The catch is that artificial intelligence like Watson doesn't think the way that people do, at least according to a great deal of scholarship, including recent work by David Watson, no relation. Whether or not things like consciousness or subjectivity can be artificially created isn't really the point, at least when it comes to machine learning and the way that it's applied, since these machines are still basically extensions of human conditions, subjectivity, and society. It isn't that AI or its developers are lying to us, it's just that they fall into a well-established pattern of new tools being treated like history-shattering novelties. French philosopher and literary critic Roland Barthes tried to redefine the word myth for the 20th century. A myth is, in his own words, a certain type of consumption, laden with literary self-indulgence, revolt, images. In short, with a type of social usage which is added to pure matter. What that means is that ideology is inevitably a part of everything human, and myth is a process of embedding different artifacts or action with ideology. Speaking through myth does a lot of work. First, it makes things that are products of culture and history appear as though they are actually natural or inevitable facts that can't be changed. A myth is just the way things are. Unsurprisingly, then, myth, intentionally or not, is used to prop up the dominant philosophy of the status quo. It's the ideas of the day as represented through, in, and by everyday life. Technology is a myth, or at least a version of it becomes myth, is something that both reveals the status quo as a natural and inevitable consequence of life as we know it, and it also conceals the historical conditions that produce that status quo. At least that's the point made by Vincent Mosco, who writes that the power of new technologies does not appear during their mythic period, when they are hailed for their ability to bring world peace, renew communities, or end scarcity, history, geography, or politics. Rather, their social impact is greatest when technologies become banal, when they literally, as in the case of electricity, or figuratively withdraw into the woodwork. It's not that these things will have no impact on human life, it's that we won't see these impacts until we stop looking, and we've moved on to the next promise of radical technical revolution. We can't blame the technologies for failing to live up to their promises, because technology doesn't make promises. People do. Not just designers, but all of us who use technologies and make promises to ourselves on its behalf. As it stands, machines don't understand context. Context is history as an ongoing process. Or, as James Baldwin says, history is not the past, it is the present. We carry our history with us. We are our history. To avoid falling into the trap of mythology, we must stew in the context that creates us and acknowledge history as a constantly constitutive process that makes us who we are.
But I am here to help. I am human. Watson is human and you are human. We are all in this together.
Apparatuses travel across time, cultures, and languages. From the beginning of how we distinguish ourselves as human with the design and use of composite tools, through the development of more and more complex apparatuses, to the ultimate promise of a mechanic assemblage that reproduces what it means to be human: intelligence, independent thought, interpretation, and ultimately creativity. According to Agamben, an apparatus does not simply refer to a mechanism, device, or physical object, such as a computer's hardware or software. It is in the arrangement of constituent elements that assemble into a network of programming, performance, texts, coders, training data, servers, readers, and users that become entangled in a web of relations with the promises of artificial intelligence and its myths of objectivity and transparency. The expectation is for AI to be more objective than a human or group of humans when analyzing data, but the data itself reflects biases that are inherently human. In an interview with Ben Dixon, Jen Wortman-Vaughn, senior researcher at Microsoft, recalls the subtle ways that AI bias can inflict harm. Wortman recalls an incident. "Last year," she said, "I was planning to take my daughter for a haircut and searched online for images of toddler haircuts for inspiration. But the images returned nearly all white children, primarily with straight hair, and more surprisingly, primarily boys. Regardless of the care taken to reduce the impact of bias in AI applications, machine learning is only as unbiased as the people who decide what data is relevant and what parameters of categorization are used for machine learning. AI is a technological tool that reflects inequalities and in turn affects the lives of people where it is applied in business, human resources, finance, and medical care, with the decisions and determinations that are made." Wortman points out, "It could cause serious problems if a machine learning algorithm being used for medical diagnosis is trained on data from one population and, as a result, fails to perform well on others. Deep learning algorithms, including IBM's Watson Studio, helps data scientists visually design neural networks. But these systems suffer from the same problems of unwanted biases arising from the training data they receive. In healthcare, this has been responsible for the misdiagnosis of skin cancer more often in people of color than patients with fair skin. What has been found is that diagnosis and recommendations for care disproportionately favors white patients due to income disparity and frequency of medical care. This has a major impact when AI is used in determining priority for patient care and the treatment of complex conditions. Systemic biases inherent in the application of AI in healthcare marks current limitations, fallacies, and failures that can be seen in the way systems of categorization and determination operate in tangible ways on people's lives.
Considering these biases and how the machines are in a way an extension of humans, what can the very hopes and apprehensions invested in Watson as a diagnostic assistant tell us about humans? What can Watson reflect back to humans?
We are often confronted to discussions and debates in which claims are made with regard to the technology in itself. We claim to be more optimistic about its potential benefits or more pessimistic about its potential harms. There results a deepening divide between these positions and perhaps a false dichotomy that can be quite misleading. We may be much more part of the question and of the answer than we think. When we focus solely on the potential benefits or harms, we may be deflecting questions to an imagined future that is somehow determined. Shannon Valor, ethicist and philosopher of technology, shifts the terms of the conversation by asking different questions. She introduces questions that help us move forward by bringing our attention to moral labor and fantasies of offloading decision-making. We often either invest great hopes in Watson for its potential benefits to offload tasks and decisions, or with great apprehension for its potential harms in the context of care. Exaggerated hopes can result in a sense of atrophy, as we offload our moral labor to a mathematical device which can never quite fulfill the requirements we've invested in it. Exaggerated apprehensions, on the other hand, can result in apathy, as we do not want to be confronted with any new technology and would rather remain in the safety of the same. Valor helps us distinguish between these terms by stating that innovation does not always lead to progress. For progress to occur, we need to engage in our moral labor and harness responsible collaboration. Technology, for Valor, is not the motor of social maintenance and resilient institutions, nor is it the motor for social decline. For Valor, it is people that maintain societies and that make up institutions. It has been, it is, and it will be about working together. Alfred North Whitehead can help us think through the relationship between innovation and progress. In The Function of Reason, written almost a century ago, he highlights that the function of reason is to promote the art of life. This, for Whitehead, is enabled through what he calls the relief of novelty and its varied freshness. Novelty can destabilize us, but it ultimately leads to shaking off the fatigue of atrophy in order to live a better life. For Whitehead, the relief of novelty comes from confronting difference, breaking out of the way of blindness, bias, the way of rhythm, repetition, and the way of transience, short-sightedness. A diagnostic assistant can either help us break out of these ways or can reinforce them depending on how we use it. When it comes to public health care, heavy and overwhelming workloads can make it almost impossible to sustain care. Perhaps we cannot offload care and moral labor, but we can offload those heavy logistical and informational processes. What these reflections point to ultimately is that the cultural object of our inquiry is not just Watson, but is also ourselves, how we work together, sifting through our shared moral labor. Progress, like the future, is something we do, and something we do together.
So if Watson and I are mostly about helping you humans with logistics and processing information, then why are there so many stories about AI becoming human? Why are researchers still trying to make us sound and feel more human?
So yeah, you're right. There are indeed so many stories about AI becoming human that can make like decisions and feel things like a human does. In Western media, many of these stories are about who will win between humans and AI, by the way. Either on the micro level, like The Matrix, or on a more intimate level with AIs fighting for their freedom as individuals, like Westworld, or movies like Her, Ex Machina, etc. But again, these stories are not really about AI. They are more about defining what makes us human, about who has the right to be human. The concept of humanity is used to exclude or control some bodies. And I'm specifically talking about domination here, not just power dynamics. Michel Foucault, in his The Ethic of Care for the Self as a Practice of Freedom, describes power as sort of a network of forces underlying any type of human relationship. Software is not good or bad per se, it's just when it stops flowing from one side to another that a state of domination begins and becomes harmful.
So if we are constantly bombarded with stories of domination about AI,
maybe that's what's making us incapable of imagining anything else. Maybe that's why we are so far from creating any conscious AI. We're stuck in this myth about AIs as things we need to control before they can control us. Most of us, we don't really understand how AI works,
besides the fact that they are in some ways better than us.
And as Sandoval explained in her book called Methodology of the Oppressed, in Western culture, we usually make meaning by linking shapes, like our signifiers, to specific concepts behind them that we call signify. So if we see something that's shaped like an AI, we'll link concepts to it instantly. Concepts of how it could someday outsmart us, and how there are maybe only two ways to go from there. We either win or lose.
And we're making these connections just because of the myth we've heard about AI. And these stories of domination, they are so polarized, with all humans on one side that would supposedly feel, think, process information all the same way, as opposed to a supposedly non-human way. If you think of the word robotic, for example, it's more or less an insult to describe someone who, for example, expresses an emotion in a way that feels disconnected from the concept that we have of that emotion.
So when a chatbot says things with a monotonous tone, don't we find them funny or uncanny just because of some cultural assumptions?
When even you're listening to me talking right now, you can hear that English is not really my native language, so I might sound more robotic than I actually am. Well, I hope I'm not that robotic in real life. You know?
So maybe we could treat artificial intelligence more like a signified concept that can take many shapes or forms.
Sometimes it's taking non-human shapes, obviously, through apps and all, but you could also see part of our human intelligence as becoming somewhat artificial, especially over the past decades.
And maybe we could see ourselves as virtual agents of care.
Maybe the concept of healthcare itself needs to feel more human, no matter which shape it takes.
Hope you enjoyed our segment of Resonance. You can find the transcripts and citations for this podcast on CJLO's SoundCloud page. Thank you for listening.
Hello, fiends. I'm John.
I'm Kim.
And we're the hosts of Nightmare on Film Street, the horror movie podcast for the casually obsessed.
Obsessed!
Now on the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
Join us every other week for candid, comedic discussions of your favorite horror movies and not-so-favorite horror movies, as well as interviews with filmmakers and horror creators.
Are you ready to finally admit that 90s horror is better than 80s horror?
And 2000s horror is worse but better than 90s horror?
This is the podcast for you. Nightmare on Film Street is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever podcasts lurk.
Join us!
Join us every Tuesday night at midnight on CJLO for Floydian Slip. It's an hour of music by Pink Floyd. Hey, it's Craig Bailey, your host for an hour from the dark side of the moon. An hour of Pink Floyd, Floydian Slip, every Tuesday night at midnight, right here on 1690 AM CJLO. Learn more online at floydianslip.com.
Y'all, this is CJLO. Won't you stay tuned for some more good music? Alright.
Displacement is usually defined as the enforced departure of people from their homes, typically because of war, persecution, or natural disaster. In its most literal sense, displacement refers to the act of moving, or the transition between different places and cultures. As such, displacement forces people to confront a sense of placelessness and dislocation, but it may also lead displaced subjects to construct a new life from the fragmented pieces of the past. Displacement transforms memory. It breaks continuity and turns time into a multiple and heterogeneous experience. In this podcast, three different threads are intertwined to create rhythmic, narrative, thematic, and poetic relationships. Displacement weaves endlessly from one space to another, never being fully able to call any of them home. Our stories trace movement and shape relationality amongst different geographical and temporal spaces. The first, narrated by me, Manuela Ochoa, is a fragmented image of Felisa Burstyn, a Colombian sculptor who was forced into exile in the 1980s. The second explores the concept of ghost notes, which has its origins in Afro-Cuban musical aesthetics and will be narrated by Greg Labrosse, a Montreal native who transferred to Colombia as an undergraduate student. And lastly, the third story describes the search for an own third space and the things one must leave behind from the point of view of Wilson Hernandez, a Colombian educator who moves to his own meandering rhythm. The use of industrial waste in most Latin American countries has a different meaning than that one in any highly industrialized country. Pieces of junk are recycled in everyday life. Things are not easily discarded. They are collected and stored for another use. Houses are made out of fragments of discarded construction materials. Machines are repaired over and over until they are physically exhausted. People fix their clothes, their cars, even their umbrellas. This process of assembling different pieces together, or the bricolage of Latin American modes of consumption, permeated Felisa's bursting artistic practice. She began to work with found pieces of scrap metal after studying sculpture in Paris. Initially, she attempted to work with plaster and bronze, as she had been taught, but those techniques were expensive and the materials were scarce in Bogotá. She made sculptures with things she had at hand and industrial materials that were previously discarded by someone else. Her sculptures are pieces from different origins welded together and supported by a minimum foothold. Her work does not present a concrete or obvious comment on a single aspect of her time. They are an amalgamation, an assemblage of comments, a mise-en-scene that is flexible enough to be rethought and reconfigured in the present. In doing so, Burstyn blocked the process of forgetting. In a poetic dimension, they can be understood as a society that changes its form constantly through social protest and struggle. In 1971, the filmmaker Luis Ernesto Arocha and the artist Felisa Burstyn worked together in the production of the short film Asilef, or Felisa, written backwards. The film shows Burstyn's scrap sculptures floating in space like satellites. In the midst of growing opposition between the United States and the Soviet Union, outer space turned into a battlefield. At the end, Burstyn grabs all her sculptures and locks them in a cabinet. The background music was a special composition by Los Tapus, resembling the Beatles across the universe. Space. Don't you see that? Los Tapus and the short film Asilef while rummaging boxes in Felisa Burstyn's house in 2009. I learned through one of my mother's friends that Los Tapus were my father, my uncle, and two of their friends. Could you believe us, babe? Burstyn is the Polish word for amber. Her parents were Polish Jews who came by boat to Colombia months before Adolf Hitler became Führer in Germany. Her widower, Paulo Leiva, remembers that after divorcing her first husband, her family killed her with a Jewish ritual, digging a tomb and placing a stone over a stone. Her first death was symbolic.
As we ride around this space.
Felisa Burstyn's artistic production was abruptly interrupted in 1981. President Julio César Turbay's military unit persecuted, tortured, and criminalized the artist for having contact with the Cuban art scene. She was forced to leave the country immediately. After his election in 1978, Julio César Turbay created an entity called Estatuto de Seguridad. Worried about the growth of guerrilla groups like FARC, M-19, and ELN, he gave the military power and freedom to judge and arrest whoever was suspicious. The military intelligence proceeded with arbitrary detentions, tortures, and persecutions. Suspicion is in fact a powerful weapon. By perpetrating the suspicions with different versions and fears, a political structure gains power. Felisa Burstyn died at a restaurant in Paris, in front of her close friend, the exile writer Gabriel García Márquez. He wrote about her death, quote, "She died without even knowing why or what she had done to die like that, nor which two simple words she could have said to avoid dying so far away from her home," end quote. While it is true that every work of art is directly related to the environment where it is exhibited, installations represent a higher stage of this use of immediate physical space. It is their three-dimensional quality that connects them to the place where they are located, and to the viewer, also inserted in that space. The journalist Daniel Samper Pisano wrote, quote, "The last day of her life, Friday, January 8, 1982, Felisa Burstyn walked with her husband Pablo Leiva on the cold streets of the Latin Quarter in Paris. She was still shocked by the visit they made together, 3 days before, to the memorial to the martyrs of the deportation that rises from an island on the Seine River, not far away from Notre Dame." End quote.
Y esta es mi casa, llena de hierros viejos, de soldadores de punto, de transformadores, de cuadros, de chatarra.
In 1943, the composer Pavel Haas wrote Study for Strings while imprisoned in the Terezín concentration camp in what is now the Czech Republic. Many members of the prisoner's orchestra, including Haas, were killed the following year in Auschwitz. However, the conductor survived and was able to reconstruct the fragments of the piece once the war ended in 1945. That same year, my mother was born in Germany. Her father, a Polish Navy officer, and her mother, a Russian forced laborer, had also survived the war. In 1949, they crossed the Atlantic on an ocean liner and started a new life in Montreal. I only became aware of Haas's composition as a young adult when I was introduced to his work in a music appreciation class at university. The professor sampled music from a wide range of genres, from Western classical music to jazz, to rhythm and blues and hip-hop, exploring the inseparable connection between music and culture. These explorations set in motion my interest in Cuban music and its complex history. As Orlando Fiol, the piano and theory instructor at the University of Pennsylvania, remarks, "Over the past century of recorded sounds, Cuban popular music has undergone great stylistic changes. expanding its rhythmic vocabularies by displacing, recombining, and layering them to form new aesthetics and sonic meanings across the musical diaspora of the United States, Latin America, and beyond. My interest in Cuban sounds stayed with me, even after moving to Colombia to pursue a master's degree in cultural studies. I was interested in studying narrative representations of the city of Cartagena from both a spatial and temporal perspective. Rhythm permeates the Caribbean coast, from internal rhythms such as the act of breathing and the fluctuations of hunger and sleep, to external rhythms such as the cycle of night and day and the tidal currents of the sea. But there are also other rhythms that exert a great influence on people's lives, the abstract rhythms of the industrialized world. These rhythms, mainly focused on coordination and efficacy, often move away from our internal sense of time and the cycles of nature. In response to this, certain individuals who find themselves caught between these subjective and abstract notions of time improvise ways to counteract their effects. Musicians, for example, speak of improvisation as a state that goes beyond temporal thinking. Possibilities can be explored through an act of letting go. Restrictions are lifted, and the notion of time is stretched. Within this stretched rhythm, musicians have more room to play. Percussionists improvise in that space, adding ghost notes to the piece of music they're playing. Ghost notes are a rhythmic concept based on Afro-Cuban aesthetics that inserts notes or rhythms in the spaces left by the other instruments. That rhythmic improvisation is what gives the music its rich, syncopated sound. An example of the Cuban aesthetics present in the musical expression of the Colombian culture is found in bullerengue. The presence of Cubans in the Colombian sugar mills of the early 20th century exerted a strong musical influence on Afro-Colombian populations established in the rural areas of the province of Bolívar. In bullerengue, the female singer improvises the song's verses, narrating her own experiences as well as historical events. This is exemplified in songs such as Mi Mamá Que Me Parió, that Petrona Martínez dedicated to her deceased mother. Her voice is always in the foreground, a symbol of human struggle that melodically and rhythmically recreates everyday life. Bullerengue is the musical testimony of a cultural heritage that has left a deep mark on the natural and cultural landscape of Colombia's Caribbean coast. Within the song's rhythmic layers, we are able to perceive accents of grief and sorrow, just as in Pavel Haas's Study for Strings. In the violent history of the region, entire communities have been displaced, uprooted from their land, and as a result, they have been forced to migrate to nearby cities in search of new sources of livelihood, a phenomenon that continues to this day. Both in the rural areas of Bolívar and in the peripheral neighborhoods of coastal cities like Cartagena, people improvise a place to call their own, adding ghost notes to the rhythms of everyday life. But what can individuals stretch when improvisation is spatial? Can rhythmic harmonies be achieved in spaces where life itself has to be improvised? Can lives be reconstructed like the fragments of a song?
There are fragments in our life stories that interweave the continuity of later subsequent displacements. In 1952, a connection was made between Cuban and Colombian music. Lucho Bermúdez, a Colombian songwriter and interpreter, was invited to Cuba by Ernesto Lecuona to participate in the Latin American Music Festival of La Habana. In that opportunity, he directed Bebo Valdez's orchestra on the radio. A part of him stayed with them in La Habana, and a part of them traveled with him back to Colombia. Years later, a Colombian saxophonist and clarinetist, my father, would attempt to honor that musical shifting. My private concerto, one which sometimes I would detest due to its intensity and frequency, would cover some of Paquito de Rivera, Machito's Afro-Cubans, and Bebo Valdez, the original soundtracks, not their impro or live sessions. That's forbidden land. Sometimes not even fully the originals. And although he would dance while playing, and you could see him enjoy himself more, he would not be yet what he was, or maybe what I wanted him to be. My dad would take out the clarinet. It was now time to study some of our music, music that has stayed in our identity and which has hybridized deeper. This is the one sound that will stick with me forever. A mix of jazz brass, African percussion instruments, Colombian sounds, soul, races, fears, sadness, resulting in immensely joyful melody. Now, he was in known places. Through music, he felt himself, he felt part of it. Tolu, Baila Simón, Carmen de Bolívar. Maybe he was still somewhat foreign, but he wasn't unwelcomed. This music was for him part of his soul, of his being. Subjectivity is continually redetermined by the fluctuating influences of those powers that surround and traverse us, as well as by the memory of those identities that might have taken and may still take our current places. Some 7 years ago, 6,186 kilometers away from home, walking outside for the first time in a minus 32 degree night, I made peace with my dreams, with where I wanted to go. I concluded that being where I was supposed to be, where it had been prepared for me, was better. Some of us grow up being pushed, some more than others, ending up in places so predetermined, so expected, that it should not surprise us in the end. What pushes us has made it always too clear. You should be a lawyer, you should have a family, you should grow up to be just like your father. I can't recall one time when he told me that, or when anybody told me that. Yet, I traversed similar paths to him, and happened to enjoy to my soul the events that he also did and still does. And yet, we are so different. The "you are studying English, you will travel abroad" hit me sooner than later, and so I did. Maybe also encouraged by the violence in my country, that one that even though you are not a direct victim, makes you want out of it all. Or maybe because what I heard constantly about fleeing away to a better life gradually inoculated my desire to stay. From Neiva to New York, back to Neiva, then to Chihuahua, then back, then once again to the States, almost passing through Kutz, then back, promising not to migrate again before I had a solid, more stable reason, something that would allow me to experiment myself more freely, more proudly, a place where I could be in battle, but where a bullet or a knife are not always waiting for you at the nearest corner. Maybe all I want is to be able to stand in front of my child. And with him, my father, together. When I reflect on this, I usually conflict with my resistance. Have I become a selfish arrogant who sought his own safety? Have I given up too soon? Is it okay to fear? Should I have ever left? How does a person grow and go about without asking themselves these questions? How long will we be asking ourselves these questions? Displacement transformed my memories of childhood. It broke the continuity of past and present, and has turned time into an intimate and ever-changing relationship with my father. There will always be that in the air, that us, that I that never faded away. There will always be in that you, what lacks in others, what others need. There will be always time to remember you, to dance to your music, with your soul, without you, but always with you.
Join us every Tuesday night at midnight on CJLO for Floydian Slip, an hour of Pink Floyd. I'm Craig Bailey, your host for an hour of music from the dark side of the moon, an hour of Pink Floyd. It's Floydian Slip every Tuesday night at midnight, right here on 1690 AM CJLO. Learn more at FloydianSlip.com.
Have you recently been in contact with someone who has tested positive for COVID-19? Are you showing flu, gastro, or COVID-19 symptoms? Are you traveling soon and want to make sure you are negative? With symptoms or no symptoms, the best way to know is getting tested. There are 22 clinics in Montreal providing testing. Tests are free. All you need is a health insurance card or any other kind of identification papers. For the full list of clinics and opening hours, visit the website santemontreal.gc.ca. This message is brought to you by CJLO.
Y'all, this is CJLO. Want you stay tuned for some more good music.
The sound of palms as flesh fills his eyes. They've seen him before and they know the price of his life. It's a lullaby for us all to cry while we help him down till his knees they crack the floor. And it's those human arms torn between official laws, while the barricade forms and screams for lies. Somebody saw him reaching to a bag, and then the liquid joins him down amongst it all. In line for that moment I see all my country and me and all the little things I've loved. Now we're here and I fall in line for that moment I see all my country and me and all the little things I've loved. Now we're here and I fall in line and as his savior, he strides on the bodies on the floor. He looks me up.
I'm a man on the street. I walk right through the storm, confidently wear a hat. You might ask me to say hello. Sometimes I pick up a paper and I take it to peep through. Maybe I'll read the comics, maybe I'll read the news. Don't talk to me, man. Don't talk to me, woman. I could be seen on every corner, and people think I'm hard to read. I'm a man on the street. I walk right through the storm, confidently wear a hat. You might ask me to say hello. Stop in front of a newsstand if a headline distracts me. I read it, I move on, like everything around me. Don't talk to me, man. Don't talk to me, oh man. I could be seen on every corner, and people think I'm hard to read.
You remember. stands beside us. She is ordering a drink. She says hello to us. Charlie says hi and asks about her boy. She says he's fine and there's a pause.